Breakfast at Sally's, Richard Lemieux. Chapter 4. Mr. C's Neighborhood. Let's get going, girl. It's cold. I maneuvered out of our warm nest. Like Melissa, I could not find my shoes. I looked under the blankets and in the bottom of the sleeping bag, and finally I crawled forward to find them under the front seat. I slipped them on, along with my coat, and started the engine to get some heat going in the van. Then I jumped out to scrape the ice off the front window. Earl and Melissa were just coming back from their potty trip to the bushes. Earl, a big man, held the little girl's hand as they climbed up the slippery hill to the parking lot.
Good morning,
stuttered Earl. It's a little frosty out here.
Sure is, I said.
Earl, the lady in the wagon called out, Katie has to go now.
I knew that was going to happen, he stammered. Hold on, I'll take her down.
Willow was now whining and scratching at the window to greet the little girls.
Puppy, puppy, Katie squealed
as she climbed out of the wagon. I let Willow out, and she jumped up on Katie first and then on Melissa, wiggling her tail wildly. She happily followed Earl and Katie to the bushes as I finished scraping the windows. Willow was delighted to have new playmates.
So it's okay to sleep here? I asked Earl when they returned.
We've been here about three months, he said. Earl walked around to my side of the van as I was finishing up the last of the window scraping.
Reverend Randy has been letting us all stay here, but it may not last much longer, he continued. The word on the street is that neighbors have been complaining and the health department is going to close it down. I don't know where we'll go if they make us leave. Walmart won't let us stay in their lot unless we have a camper and buy something. It's safe here. We got to be careful, you know, if you know who sees us. The wife's afraid they'll take the kids away if they see us.
Earl stopped talking and took his arm and wiped it across his runny nose. His mustache glistened with the moisture. I thought he looked just like a little boy, wiping his nose with his sleeve that way. His hair stuck out from underneath an Oakland Raiders ski cap. He wore an olive green jacket with one of the pockets torn and hanging off the side. I noticed a hand-carved round wooden peace symbol hanging around his neck.
You a Raiders fan? I asked, pointing to his hat.
No, I got this free down at the Army, he replied. The lady sleeping under the eaves, is she okay? I asked, nodding in that direction.
That's Barbara, Earl said.
Well, she's kinda okay, she continued. She's kinda...
He moved his hand in a circular motion around his head.
She was a nurse at the hospital up the hill a few years ago. Then she got hit in the head in an accident on the way to work one day and just about died. Barbara spent three months in the hospital and was never the same, you know. Her husband left her. She lost her job and her house. She's been here for six months.
My eyes surveyed the parking lot, and Earl said, "That's Robert in the big, noisy white van. He's another screwed-up NAM vet. He's a nice guy. He's just got screwed over at the plant so many times that he couldn't take it anymore, and he punched his boss. He ended up in jail. He's a good carpenter, but he can't find work. He's a good guy, but be careful around his van. He's got two big white shepherds in there. Ba and Mary live in that great Buick with the flat tire," Earl pointed to the next car in line.
They're still cuddling right now. They are tweeters, you know, crack users. Won't be up till noon. They fight a lot.
The cold air was beginning to chill me, and my body was calling out for a cup of coffee and a bush of my own, not necessarily in that order. "I've got to get going," I said. "I'm headed down to the Salvation Army for breakfast.
As I started to get into the van, Earl moved closer to me. "Mister, I was wondering if you would be able to loan me a couple of bucks for gas," he asked. "I hate to ask, but..." His voice trailed off. I had dipped into my pocket and pulled out the 2 tens C had given me the night before. I handed Earl one of them. "Just keep it. Don't worry about paying me back, okay?"
"Thanks," Earl stuttered, and then he smiled at me.
My name is Earl," he said, extending his hand. "That's Betty, my wife," he added, turning and nodding toward his car. "And those are our daughters, Katie and Melissa."
"And I'm Richard," I smiled in return.
"Come on, Willow," I called. We both hopped in the van and closed the door. Earl stepped up to the window.
We'll probably see you down there now that we have gas money."
"I'll probably be back tonight," I said.
"Get here early," he said. "This place fills up fast. You were lucky to get this spot last night."
As I looked over my shoulder and began to back the van out of the parking spot, I could hear Betty telling the girls,
"Brush your hair real good. We're going to go get some breakfast."
I cracked the window, and Willow stuck her nose out into the morning air. We were headed to pick up C. The Armadillo was strategically located next to Allen's Minimart. There was a dumpster right beside Allen's where C could get a day-old paper each morning. In fact, he could get a paper from Hong Kong that Allen, who was Chinese, tossed away. The location was also within easy walking distance of the Maple Leaf Tavern, a run-down bar that leaned toward the road but somehow had a perfectly level pool table. That was the only really level spot in the room. You felt like you were on one of those oblique fun houses with a moving floor if you had to navigate to the bathroom. The sideways angle of the tavern appeared to be about 20 degrees before the first beer. After 2 beers, maybe 10 degrees, and after 4 beers, everything seemed perfectly level. The Maple Leaf also had a beer garden, horseshoes, friendly folks, and draft beer for a buck. Popcorn was free. The Leaf didn't serve a microbrew. It had Bud and Bud Light on tap. Milwaukee's Best in a can was the most popular. And for the connoisseur, there was Chablis and White Zin from a box. It wasn't like Bill Gates was going to pop in on his way home from the office. The Leaf was a slate-gray building stained by multiple layers of mildew with a pretty pink front door just 4 feet from the street. The men's bathroom was adorned with pre-breast implant Playboy centerfolds dating back to 1969. The patrons of the Leaf were obsessed with bodily functions. At almost any time of the day, a belching or farting contest could break out. Statements like, "I don't give a darn," or "up your ass," accentuated most conversations that could be heard over the roar of country songs about Texas women with big tits and butts. When C pleaded, "Please, no more flatulence," the patrons thought he was talking about a French beer. The Leaf had its regulars who cherished their stools at the bar. There was camaraderie and caring. When one of the Leaf's soldiers was late for sentinel duty on his stool, there were worried glances towards the door. Disagreements over politics, religion, and whether Dolly Parton's breasts were real, fake, or weapons of mass destruction became heated on occasion, but always ended peacefully. The harshest of insults were forgiven. They all knew they would be back on the same bar stools again tomorrow, God willing, and might need a friend. No grudges were carried home from the Leaf. The patrons would not have liked the comparison, but it was almost Parisian. Hemingway would have lingered there. Norman Rockwell would have painted there. Sharon was the daytime bartender, and Charlotte ran the place at night. Sharon was a virtuoso at handling the bar, often doing so with a Salem menthol long hanging from her lips. She was a big-hipped lady, maybe 40, with black hair held in a ponytail with a rubber band. She glided behind the bar,
watching each patron for some signal that they were dry and needed a refill, or for a flash of greenbacks laid on the bar to play an assortment of pull tabs stapled to the wall. It was as if she could read the minds of her customers as she swiped a 10 spot off the bar, saying, "You want 10 on lucky 8s?" When there was a brief lull in the action, she would retreat to the end of the bar and work on Sunday's New York Times crossword puzzle. But no one ever felt neglected on Sharon's watch. Sharon wasn't much up on current events. She didn't know that Dick Cheney was the vice president, that Dennis Hastert was the Speaker of the House, that William Rehnquist was the Chief Justice, or that the Pope's name was John Paul II. But she knew the important things in her world, like the names of the last 6 people voted off the island in Survivor, and who won on American Idol. Sharon also knew everybody's birthday, and that Harold had his gallbladder removed on St. Patrick's Day in 1995, that Helen's husband died the day before Halloween in 1990, and she still misses him, that Jean wears a colostomy bag, and that Steve's wife was running around on him while he was off to the Gulf War. Steve didn't know it, and she wasn't going to tell. She also knew that old Bill had a DWI last year, so she had established a 3 highball limit for him. She would coyly flash 3 fingers when she served him his last drink of the day, rather than announcing to all in attendance. In a voice like Rosie O'Donnell's, Sharon would welcome each patron with the proper greeting. When C arrived, she would usually call out, "Here comes trouble." C did his best to bring culture to the Leaf one day by standing on the bar and reading a poem called Casualty by the Irish poet Seamus Heaney. He held the book high as he read. He was belched and farted down and carried out the door, but he kept reading nevertheless, raising his voice. I found out later that C had been asked to leave, and in some cases removed by force, from just about every tavern in town for a variety of offenses. He and Robert Frost were booted out of Brewski's, and W. Somerset Maugham and C. were unceremoniously tossed from the Blue Goose. Allen's Mini Mart was open from 7 in the morning to 10 at night, 7 days a week, except from 6 to 7 in the evening when Allen went home for dinner. Allen's was staffed by Allen and nobody else. Allen was a man of few words. He would sit on a stool at the end of the counter in his store with his arms folded. A sign posted by the cash register stated, "Please ring bell for service." When a customer would come in, Allen would wait with arms folded while the customer picked out the items for purchase and then rang the bell at the counter. Allen would then quickly hop off his stool, make the transaction, and then return to his stool and fold his arms across his chest once again. That's the way he treated everyone except C. Allen talked to C. He liked him. I asked C one day why Allen talked to him. "He's my neighbor," C replied. "You know, like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood." Then he sang, "Would you be mine? Could you be mine? Won't you be my neighbor?" "He's very intelligent," C said of Allen. "He's like Buddha. When he has something to say, it's profound. Allen just skips all the small talk." This morning I parked the van next to the Armadillo and walked into Allen's. I rang the bell and Allen leaped off the stool. "Do you have any Tums?" I asked. Allen handed me a package, took my 10, gave me change, and returned to his perch. He didn't say a word. I went out and knocked on the door of the Armadillo. There was no answer. I waited a few minutes and then knocked again. I could hear clunking around inside, and then the door opened. 2 cats came pouncing out to greet me, followed by C, who appeared a little frazzled and was rubbing his eyes. "Good morning," he said, his voice creaking. "I stayed up last night reading Horatio Hornblower. I started out with the idea of reading just a few pages to fall asleep, and the next thing I knew, it was 5 o'clock. Purring and meowing, each of the cats rubbed against one of his legs. "Meet my Lynx and Calico," C said, introducing his fuzzy friends. "They keep me warm at night." "Come in and take a look around," C invited. I stepped on the metal fold-down step and peeked inside C's home. Martha Stewart would have had a heart attack on the spot. Pots and pans and dirty dishes were piled in the small sink. Heads of lettuce and bunches of carrots and loaves of bread were piled in a corner on top of a mountain of dirty clothes. There must have been about 300 books, many sprouting makeshift bookmarks and piles of handwritten notes lying on the bed. A crow had landed on the roof, and its call captured C's attention. "The crows are hungry," he said, grabbing a loaf of bread and pulling the plastic tie from the end as he headed outside. He broke the bread into pieces and tossed them to the birds as he talked. "I've been here since August or September," he said. "I've just been waiting for you." I didn't know what to say. "Are you ready to go to Sally's?" I asked. "You'll have to excuse me this morning," C said, his gravelly voice breaking. "I stayed up too late with Hornblower and Captain Morgan to go anywhere except to bed." "Well, I'd better be going," I said, heading for the van. "I think they're having gruel this morning," C said, laughing. "Overcooked oatmeal in a big pot. Hey, would you do me a favor, though? Take something down to Jake for me?"
"Sure."
C retrieved a wrinkled bag from the armadillo and handed it to me. "Here," he said, reaching in his pocket. "Here's $10 for delivering it. It saves me some time." So I took the bag and headed for Sally's. I wanted to look inside the bag but chose not to. I wondered if I was carrying pot, needles, contraband, or some illicit drug. Sally's was only 10 minutes away, and I drove carefully. I breathed a sigh of relief when I got there and handed Jake the rumpled bag, saying, "C asked me to give this to you." "How is the old boy this morning? Still his birthday? Still 33, is he?" Jake asked, taking the bag from my hand. He opened the bag, looked, and then reached inside. "Great," he said, pulling out a paperback book. "Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption," Jake said, holding up the novella. "Have you read it?" he asked. "No," I answered. "I've seen the movie," Jake continued. "I like Morgan Freeman."
"There are places not made of stone. Yet let me tell you something, my friend. Hope is a dangerous thing."
Then he motioned to the serving line, saying, "Let's go get some gruel." As we headed up to collect our bowls, I heard a voice, "Richard!" It was Earl, Betty, and the two girls sitting at a table in the back of the room. Earl raised his hand and smiled as he waved. I waved back. I ate 3 bowls of oatmeal and then decided to take the money C had given me last night and this morning and go out into the world. With my stomach full and warm and a few bucks in my pocket, there seemed to be the faintest rebirth of hope, or at least a willingness not to give in to despair. Perhaps it was time for an adventure. Perhaps I needed to go searching for angels in Bremerton, Washington. What harm could it do?
Breakfast at Sally's. Chapter 5. Going Looking for Angels. A fog had settled over the city. As I pulled out of the alley beside Sally's, I had no idea where I was going or what I was going to do. I was just going for a ride, with no destination. In a few blocks, I came to a T-junction. Most of the cars turned left, so I turned right. Big white letters spelling out Puget Sound Naval Shipyard were painted on the side of a looming old brick building on my left, set behind the high fence that ran the length of the street. On my right side was a string of little houses, block after block of them, built side by side. I thought of that old song Pete Seeger used to sing, "Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same." I kept on driving and came to another T in the road. This time, most of the people turned right, so I turned left. As I rounded the corner, I could see the tall towers of a line of old aircraft carriers in the distance. So I slowed down as I got closer. They were mammoth World War II-era ships. They sat in the harbor side by side, gray ghosts from another time and place. The traffic just whizzed past them, drivers changing lanes as if they were in the final lap of the Daytona 500. It was a dumping ground for old ships. Stray thoughts continued to rattle around in my brain. I wondered if I was alive.
Perhaps I had succeeded in my leap from the bridge, and this was just some dream in the final stage of dying. Perhaps I was a ghost. The sound of a horn directly behind me verified that I was still among the living. Looking in my rearview mirror, I saw the face of a young man. I could see his eyes as he brought his Ford truck within inches of my bumper, yelling obscenities and flicking his cigarette ash out the window. He pulled out to pass me, the blaring music of his stereo jarring my fragile nerves. Three other vehicles passed by me, including the ice cream wagon, bellowing its doodly-doodly tune. The driver gave me the finger. The road I was on branched up ahead into two freeway entrances, one heading north, but I didn't have enough gas to go far that way, and the other heading south toward the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, and I couldn't face seeing that again today. I pulled off to the side of the road, rolled down my window, and turned off the engine. I stared out at the ships. I remembered one of my friends telling me about them a few years ago when I was on my way to a round of golf. This was a graveyard, all right. Like those old iron hulks, I seemed to be trapped in not quite life. We had driven past Bremerton a number of times, my affluent golf buddies and I, on the way to a well-manicured course called Gold Mountain. With my polished ping-zing golf clubs in the back of my van, Mark, Ted, Steve, and I would cruise along. We were an odd foursome. Mark and I were staunch Republicans, and Steve and Ted were dedicated Democrats. We would jab at each other with political swordplay, but we also knew when to stop, just before drawing blood. We were linked together in our worship of the God of Golf, at least once a week. One morning, we exited at the Cloverleaf just at the edge of the city and drove to a local restaurant for breakfast before hitting the links. We swung into a parking place right near the door. As we got out, I locked the doors with my keychain remote. "The van still running pretty good?" Ted asked. "Sure is," I replied. "What did Danny DeVito call that type of van in Get Shorty?" Ted asked. "The Cadillac of minivans," I replied. We went into the bar adjoining the dining area and sat down. The waitress stepped up right behind us, menus in hand. She knew good tippers when she saw them. She could tell by our attire. I was sporting my tan $250 Mephisto loafers and a $125 Cutter and Buck polo shirt. Steve, a tall, sandy-haired attorney, was pure Johnson & Murphy, and Mark, an insurance salesman, wore his Dockers golf ensemble, shirt, pants, and belt. Ted, a contractor, was a Callaway man, with the logo stitched on the breast pocket of his shirt, on the wallet pocket of his blue pants, and even on his socks. Altogether, we could have stepped right off the pages of Golf magazine. I scooted into a seat at the booth that faced out into the busy street and glanced at my Rolex. "What's our tea time?" I asked. "We're up at 12:05," answered Steve. "We've got plenty of time." "Then I'll have a Bloody Mary to get me rolling," I said to the waitress. She nodded in response to my order. "You headed for the golf course?" she asked, handing each of us a menu. "How did you guess?" Mark smiled. "I think I'll have a Bloody Mary, too." "And you two gentlemen?" the waitress asked Ted and Steve. "Just coffee for me," Steve said. "Coffee for me, too," Ted replied, opening his menu. "I recommend the Eggs Benedict here," Ted said. "You've eaten here before?" I asked. "Yeah, I've been in here a few times when I've been down here bidding on some projects," he said. "Did you land any of those bids?" Steve asked. "No," Ted said. "Actually, good jobs are few and far between down here. When they built the mall up the highway, the city began a slow death. First the Sears and then the Penny's closed. It's like a ghost town now." He nodded toward the downtown area. "There's lots of bums wandering around the town during the day. Some call it Bummer Town. And at night, you really don't want to go down there. Lots of homeless people begging for money to buy booze. Lots of druggies, too. There's meth everywhere, and it's pretty rough. You could get killed.
Well, it's obvious you're not working for the Bremerton Chamber of Commerce, I laughed.
Two waitresses rounded the corner with laden trays.
It's breakfast time, gentlemen, one of them said as she served us our feast.
As I dug into my Eggs Benedict, I asked, so is there anything good about this town?
The Gold Mountain Golf Course, Ted said, laughing.
We all joined in.
And that little theater downtown is kind of nice.
I took the last sip of my Bloody Mary and signaled for another.
I'll take another too, Mark said, holding up his glass.
This is a Navy town, Ted said, after taking a slurp of his coffee.
The town booms when the country's at war, he continued.
3,000 or 4,000 sailors walk down the ramps of those ships when they make port, head straight for the booze, women, and cars.
Hell, isn't that what all young men want? Steve said as the waitress came back with our fresh drinks and coffee refills.
Years ago, the core of the town was lined with bars, and then the Catholics and Protestants began a building campaign, 2 churches for every bar that opened. They wanted to save those poor lost sailors. In the late 30s, Bremerton made Ripley's, believe it or not, as the city with the most churches in one city block.
Well, Ted, aren't you just a Thornton Wilder of this town? Mark tossed in, a smirk on his face.
You know what's really funny? Ted asked. Now, despite all the churches, Washington State ranks lowest in the nation in church attendance, and Bremerton ranks lowest in the state.
So when was the last time you went to church, Steve?
I went last Christmas, Steve replied.
Mark, Ted continued.
I go every once in a while, looking for insurance clients, Mark answered.
And you, Richard?
Ted turned to me.
I went to a funeral maybe 5 years ago, I replied.
No wonder you missed so many 3-foot putts, Ted laughed. You're not putting enough in the collection plate.
Who are the players here? Mark asked Ted.
A guy named Bremer was a real estate tycoon, Ted replied. He bought and sold land and made big bucks when the Navy needed a port. He's long gone now, but his fingerprints are all over the city. His money helped build a college and a bunch of other stuff, too.
You know, Bill Gates' great-grandfather lived here.
Really? I didn't know that, Steve said.
Yeah, Ted said. He had a second-hand store down near the waterfront. But right now, the city is dying. It's got a 30% poverty rate, more than its share of slumlords, and a whole lot of homeless people.
I took the last bite of my Eggs Benedict.
Why doesn't the city just chase the homeless over to Seattle? I asked. Get them jobs. Put them to work at McDonald's.
Ted laughed. You know, Rich, you've been listening to Rush Limbaugh way too much. You want a simple solution to a complicated problem. The homeless need help, a place to live, a place to get cleaned up, a well-paying job, and they need respect and kindness and motivation. You've got people with broken minds, broken hearts, broken spirits, and sometimes broken bodies. Don't be so dismissive. It could happen to any of us.
That was a thought none of us wanted to entertain. We were momentarily silent until Steve chimed in with levity again.
Except Rich, he said. He's the man who has everything. He's the self-made man.
They all snickered.
You guys are just trying to get me to pick up the tab, I said.
Well, it's your turn anyway, Ted said.
He glanced at his watch.
Hey, we've got to get going. The golf gods are calling.
I want to hit a bucket of practice balls before we tee off.
Me too, Steve said, as they both moved out of the booth and stood up.
I grabbed the check and, pulling my money clip from my pocket, peeled off 4 20s and dropped them on the table. Then I rushed out to catch up with my buddies.
That's tonight's episode. At this point, we must break off our reading. You've been hearing Breakfast at Sally's by Richard Lemieux. Copyright in 2009. It is read with the permission of the publisher Skyhorse Publishing of New York. Join us next time on the bookshelf for Breakfast at Sally's. I'm Jeff Hazen.